Hello and welcome to the Pony Sink for January 15th, 2019. Hey everybody, let's go ahead and just go around, say your name, say hello. I'm Andy.
Hi Andy.
I'm hi. Sean.
Oh hi. Yeah, hi Sean.
Sylvan, say hi.
Hi, I'm Sylvan. This is Paul. Say hi, Paul.
I'm Paul.
I'm Joe.
I'm Theo.
I'm Gordon.
That worked really well. Nice work, everybody. All right. Let's start as we always do by looking at some RFCs. Any new RFCs? We have a RFC from Sean to remove traits from Pony. That's 138. So I know we've talked about this times.
John Mum is going to add a comment for one thing that traits are handy for, which I think is something that we should account for in this. So you can use, and he'll put the example in, but you can use traits where you have a trait which has nothing in it, to basically have an open-ended like enum type, right, where you say primitive green is color, primitive red is color, and unlike a union type, you can people could keep adding things to this, and that is definitely something that you can do with traits right now that you can't really do with interfaces, and is definitely something that when John puts it on, we should talk about what that would mean.
Okay.
So there's a pattern for that called marker methods. I'm not saying it's beautiful or anything like that, but if you say interface color and you say that it has a method is color,
That's literally what I talked with John this morning, and then followed up with, but that's really friggin' ugly compared to what you can do with traits.
I think that that's pretty much true. The marker method, of course, can have an implementation in the interface. It's just none, and that way, every time something wants to be color, it can also say is color, much like with traits. So what it does is it adds the method, and it adds the possibility for confusion. Because there could be some other type that has that method for whatever reason with a compatible signature.
Yeah. The thing I mentioned to John, just as throwing it out there because I hadn't really thought about it, was whether it's called trait or not, that you have something that's like how you can use trait for that, but it's not something that has methods or anything, but it's merely like something that allows you to note that, hey, this is, I specifically want this to be included as part of this, like, I keep calling them open enums, because it's not really an enum, but it is kind of an enum in the sense that it's open, so you know what
I think actually an open enumeration is an excellent description of what it is. I think that's perfect. I guess the only thing that I'd say is, rather than having the language feature in sort of the quest for removing language features, that if we have a pattern that we follow for that kind of thing, so that we have essentially a naming scheme for the marker method that says the marker method should be is underscore trait underscore type name, possibly even is underscore trait underscore some package, useful package name, type name, right? Like, it depends how far you want to go with this. It only ever gets written once. None of the things that want to be in that open enumeration need to write that method. All they do is do exactly what they do now, which is say is color.
Well, it's like fun is color, parentheses, arrow, none.
You just have a default implementation, so you don't.
Right. So that goes on the interface, but it only gets written once. Exactly, Joe.
Okay. That sounds clever.
Careful.
No, I'm giving my honest assessment of it. Yeah. That's my first reaction.
Yeah, I apologize.
No, I mean, it's something that is also literally a thing that I mentioned to John as one of the first things that came to my mind.
So, sorry if this was answered last week, but is this, other than like just sort of the simplicity goal of having fewer features and maybe fewer overlapping features to choose from, do we gain anything in terms of like implementation, like clever stuff we can do in the compiler because we removed this and so on? Does it make things simpler in that way, or is it just kind of like less things for the user to have to remember and know about?
Mostly less you think for the user to need to remember and to make decisions about. If there is some degree of stuff that's gained in the compiler in that there's a whole chunk of code that can go away that's specific to dealing with interfaces.
And that has a bug that doesn't exist in the interface code.
That is true.
because yes, I mean that is an unfortunate thing where you get basically the same functionality right now from trait and interface, but you, because there are different code paths, you can get bugs in one that you don't get in the other.
Yeah. But you're right, Joe. I liked your comment on this RFC because I think that's a very reasonable position, that it's a pretty apathetic. It's why are we really doing this? And my best explanation is, when a programmer sits down and thinks, should I make this a trait or an interface? Really, that's unnecessary cognitive load.
Okay.
But actively encouraged, right? Like, I don't know.
Traits don't have any runtime difference with interfaces.
At runtime, a trait and an interface are exactly the same.
But at compile time, you know, because the traits are nominal, you have that open-ended enum thing that you can't do with a can't do with an interface.
That's right. So I think the open enumeration thing is important. Let's get John's comment on that and not do any voting on this yet. Is that
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I would definitely like to have a solution to the open-ended enum thing that we come up with where I can update the RFC to include that as well for whatever it is.
Right.
Because that would then be taking away, I think, you know, as John pointed out, that is the one really valuable thing that you can do with traits that you can't do with interfaces.
Right.
And there should be some way to do it.
Other than marker methods, I assume you mean.
Well, I would argue very strongly for even just like a new keyword to replace trait or something, which only allows you, which doesn't have any methods or behavior or something or anything before marker methods. Yes, but I could be swayed.
Okay.
Maybe that's probably a lie.
All right. Any other RFCs we want to talk about? That was the only new one.
As far as I know, there haven't been any changes to previous stuff yet.
The variance one. We talked about it last time.
We did.
But then there was this higher kind of types thing.
Yep.
And then we talked it more after the sync. We realized that we couldn't figure out why higher kind of types.
Yep. Sorry, I completely forgot. Thank you, Paul. So I apologize, Joe. I want to run through your use case on number 1, 2, 3 again. Is that okay?
Yeah, let me just try to get myself back in that mindset.
Yeah. And this is entirely my fault. I know for a fact that Joe explained this to me and got me to a point where I understood. And now I've blown it and I don't remember.
And by Elijah is trying to implement this right now. There is a code that he's working on for this.
There is. Absolutely is.
So you want me to run through things, or do you want to ask me questions?
I'll just try and ask you a question there, okay. And then you can guide me on what I'm asking, if that's okay.
Sure.
So I think your last comment on there is the one that I find most important, I think, which is you're saying you're actually not looking to extract an interface. Instead, what you were looking for is, as you say, interacting with different reifications of the same generic type.
What comment where?
Sorry, that's the second to last comment or the last of Joe's comments on RFC 123.
123?
Yes.
Okay, I thought we were looking at 134. Okay. All right. Okay. Sorry.
No worries.
Oh.
The part, the brain freeze that I'm having is I'm once again having trouble disambiguating between extracting an interface and a different way, having a single way of interacting with multiple reifications, since that sounds like an interface in my brain.
Yeah, I mean, well, so I don't know. It's sort of like an interface versus a trait, honestly. And that's why that's the. I don't know that either you or Paul agreed with that analogy, but I still think it's a reasonable analogy, right? Because we're talking about a difference between. I don't care about matching any old type that. I think it's okay if it matches other types that have the same signature. The same like set of, you know, methods with those signatures, but that part's sort of irrelevant to me. So it's sort of like the case where I don't care if it's a trait or an interface. But the reason I was calling it a trait, which again I don't think you or Paul liked this analogy, but. If you look at my code comments up where, yeah, Paul says this wouldn't actually be a trait, but some mix between the two, an interface which requires the class name to be the same. I was thinking of it as an anonymous trait that was implicitly created as well as being implicitly applied to your class, so that your class was the only type that was nominally linked to the trait. I think this way of thinking about it is easier to understand than saying the compiler checks the class name, but maybe it was differently. So, again, I don't care if it's a trait or an interface, but... That part's sort of irrelevant to me. It's amazingly like if I have a, we were using elements, I guess, or cell as the example here. If I have a cell generic type, and I want to, you know, say anything that is covariant with a, you know, for cell, I want to accept that here because I don't care about the contravariant stuff in this case, right? I'm only calling methods that use that covariance. That's the basic use case that I want here.
Yep. Okay.
Now, whether we allow other, arbitrary types to supply the same methods and be substituted there, I don't really care either way. I would be fine saying that we can't or saying that we can.
Right.
It sounds like if we're removing traits, probably the most consistent thing to do here is say that, yeah, this acts like an interface rather than a trait in that, like, it is open-ended. You need not be the original type to say that you meet the interface.
Okay.
The problem with the interface thing is that then adding methods to a class is a breaking change.
Yep.
Which is why making it a trait, like sort of a trait, not a trait.
Well, is it? So the other part that I think is really interesting is that Joe pointed out that. Well, let me rephrase that. Joe, please help me because I want to know some of the examples seem to imply that you don't want necessarily all of the methods, but maybe that's wrong. You do want all of the covariant or all of the contravariant methods?
Well, in the original mindset that I was thinking about it, right, like that was sort of a choice I didn't have to make of whether I wanted them all or not, because
by definition, you have them all. Got it.
Yeah. You have them all implicitly just because you're only talking about a single generic type.
In which case, example, I think you don't. We wouldn't view that as a breaking change, even though even if we said this implements an integer. The fact that you're changing that class is not just implicit, but explicitly changing what it means to be that interface.
Sorry, Sarah.
So if you add a method to the actual concrete type that you're doing this to, you're saying, well, it's a breaking change for anything else that, that would be this.
Yes.
But under Joe's formulation, he has no intention that anything else is this.
Yeah, yeah. That's...
So adding, changing the base type is like saying you were adding a, you, if we viewed it as a trait, equivalently you would be adding a method to the trait that does not have a default implementation. Also, in some sense, a breaking change. But I don't think it matters whether it's a trait or an interface.
But I think in the trait representation,
yeah,
other classes cannot implement it. They cannot say is this thing. So you add a thing to the trait, but you also add it to the only implementation of it.
Yeah, but the same goes from the interface point of view, right? If you went, if you did try to masquerade as one of these things, mm-hmm. and one of these things changed, it's fine. It's just as if you redefined the trait. If you, does that make any sense? If you think of it as what if the trait were being being defined separately from the base type?
Yeah.
Rather than implicitly.
So something, Sylvan, you might want to think about with this line of thinking is how we would handle private methods. I guess in my conception of this feature, private methods would be included in this because like if you're dealing with it only within the package, it should be fine to say that, you know, okay, I want to use private methods of cell within the package. But then, you know, can, I guess you could have private methods on interfaces already, right?
Yes, you can.
But you shouldn't be allowed to.
It's not that we shouldn't be allowed to. I think that we should be allowed to, but we need to follow a more precise subtyping rule that says something that provides that private method must also be in the same package as the interface or have pulled that the package of the interface in order to be allowed to define it. And that's not that bad in the compiler. It's sort of, and in some sense, it's intuitive for the programmer, right? Because what you don't want to do is late define the interface that allows you to break the encapsulation copy. That's a bug right now, by the way.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's reasonable to include the private methods. I don't see a fundamental problem with that at all.
So I guess so. The point you're driving at with this discussion that kind of was the impetus of it was you're questioning your earlier assessment that higher kind of types is a is a good replacement for this feature?
I am, yeah.
Okay.
That's exactly what I'm questioning.
Oh, that's how we got here. Okay.
Yeah.
I missed that at the beginning, and I've been just sitting here going, why are we talking about this one when we mentioned the higher kind of types at the beginning?
Yes.
Yeah.
That I think the work that's being done on higher kind of types is super interesting, but not necessarily going to solve this. And it's, I think it's on me to have another look and see if I can come up with a way to do with this higher kind of types. And if not, let's assume I was full of beans and let's go back to Joe's original proposal.
Along with higher kind of types?
Yeah.
Okay.
Unless I can, I or anyone else, let's not limit that, can find a way to express this usefully. Using higher kind of types.
Okay.
I think that's about it. That's all I have on this one. Thanks.
Okay. Anybody else? Any RFCs we want to talk about? Okay, We'll put a nail in RFCs then for now. See here. Issues. Let's see. Any new issues? Sorry. Let's do pull requests first. Sorry. Pull requests. So we have Joe's 2976, the work in progress on LLVM 7.0.1 compatibility.
Beautiful.
Hooray for that.
Yeah, Gordon and I have been working on that one.
Okay. So that one's marked do not merge. I know there's been some discussion about it. Anything we want to say about that here? Sounds like not.
The only discussion worth having is right now it is, I think it's working except for the JIT code that's used for some compiler tests.
So the stack to heap is working? I mean, heap to stack?
Was that something that was not working before, Gordon?
Yeah, that was not working in 5 and 6.
Yeah, I haven't even got to the point where I can test that yet.
Oh, okay. All right.
Right now I'm still, there's still some assertions in generated code. So.
Okay.
Gotcha.
I only have like a couple hours a week to work on this, so.
Yeah.
What assertions were you seeing in generated code, Gordon? I was able to run the test suite, after including the fixes that I had on there, I was able to run the test suite with no assertions.
Yeah, on Windows, I can't remember what assertions I was seeing, but when it tries to compile this standard library, it asserts on something that I can't remember right now. So,
okay. And that was with my recent commits included. Sorry, not recent, but last week.
Yeah, that's on.
All right. Yes, because that's different from Linux. I was able to get everything. I was able to run the standard library tests on Linux. So.
Oh, nice.
So Joe, I don't know if you had a chance to look, but were you able to see if any heap to stack happened?
No, I didn't get into that. Isn't that like disabled temporarily, right?
For 5 and 6, right, but not 3.
Right.
Right.
There's a comment in the code generator somewhere. I can't remember.
Okay.
If I have a spare moment, I'll try turning it to I'll try disabling the workaround and see what happens.
Well, I should do it on Linux because if you're on Windows and you're already having other problems, that won't be a great indicator. So I will make a point to find it and just disable the workaround on my machine.
Yeah, I have a Bionic VM as well. I can do it on Linux.
Ah, cool. Y'all already know this, but I'll just point out where the code is in case anybody is interested. It's in the compiler in the code gen, libponyc code gen in genop.cc, and I suspect that there may be some issues with LLVM architecture for these custom passes having changed, so it may be that we need a re-implementation of this thing to work correctly on 6 and 7, and I just don't know. I don't know how much of that is available. This is an implementation that has been ported up from 3.6 and through 4, and so there's every chance that there's stuff that has changed more fundamentally in LLVM since then.
And so specifically, we're looking at in the heap to stack implementation there, we're looking at the stuff that's, looking at like line 305, where it says this is a workaround for a problem with LLVM 4 and 5 on Unix with hoisting loads. You figure out if the real reason LLVM 4 and 5 is code when hoisting stack allocated.
Yeah, that's the line.
And that's the only one that needs to be, put back to test this.
Yeah, that's right.
Cool. All right. I'll do that today.
Cool. Okay. anything we want to say on this higher kind of types work?
On 2972?
2972, yes.
Hell of a first issue for Elijah to take on.
It's pretty awesome, isn't it? Like,
it's kind of amazing.
Super impressive. I hope he's listening to this at some point. This is really impressive.
Nice work, Elijah. Okay. Any other PRs anybody wants to talk about? Going once, going twice, nothing? Okay. Cool. On to issues. Sean, you said you marked some stuff as needs discussion during sync. So we've got four needs discussion during sync issues. So let's start at 2837, memory leak.
Needs discussion during sync. Oh, I hear myself. I think that one's been marked as yes. Could other people test the code in 2837 and see if they get a leak? I do not.
Who's echoing?
It's me.
Okay. So, yeah. Anybody here want to take that?
I apologize. 2837?
No, 830.
837. Way back in the day.
Thank you.
Yeah, I went back and checked that out. I can't replicate it.
Okay.
Anymore. The more interesting one is 1007.
1007. Looking now.
Okay, 1007.
So there's my echo again. I started looking at this because of one where somebody opened where they were thinking that actors weren't being garbage collected, and so I think there are definitely two things with the current setup, which is that if you start up an actor and it doesn't receive a lot of messages and it doesn't use a lot of memory, and it will not get garbage collected. It just won't. And if it holds references to anything else, et cetera, it won't. From that, and that the cycle detector doesn't run very often and seems to generally take a really long time for things to actually be garbage collected. Whereas if you run with no block, there's that check, Sylvan, remember that we put in some time ago, you and I discussed, where it's like, hey, if there are no references to this thing and the message queue is empty and we're not running with the cycle detector, then go ahead and garbage collect me right now, which is at the tail end of the the after run, right? That's at least my supposition of why this thing explodes in memory usage unless you do Pony GC initial one and Pony no block, in which case it happily sits around 3 megs of memory.
That's extremely interesting.
And without those two things, it within seconds, it's up to like 10, 12 gigs of memory.
Right. Okay. The cycle detector is keeping references to actors. And that's why if you're using the cycle detector, you can't self-collect, because the cycle detector may then later try to read that to determine that whether or not it's doing the right
thing. Not may, definitely does. I know, because I was playing around with it last night and watching it seg fault in multiple different places.
I said may. That's me. It absolutely does, yes. So there's, I think, so I'm sorry, I'm being a little cagey here, but there's some work that I've done at the lab and some other people have worked on at the lab on actor collection that we hope to be able to bring forward at some point. It eliminates the cycle detector entirely. And lets all of this happen so that there is a normal mode of operation in which acyclic graphs are deterministically collected and cyclic graphs are eventually collected, but without requiring a cycle detector and also still being without locking up threads ever to do collection. That means I'm in a bad place for thinking about how to fix the cycle detector, because I immediately go to, I have to fix the cycle detector, I already figured out how to get rid of it. So I think there's a couple of options here. One is, certainly if anyone else wants to look at this, please, please, please do. There may well be a way to hack around the cycle detector looking at an actor's memory like that, and a way to deal with it. The other is to say, we accept that this is going to live until that work does or does not get materialized, i.e. open sourced, and deal with it then. The other, I don't know, maybe that's the only options I can think of.
So I'm just, because I kind of got curious with it, right? Yeah. I at least want to know why the cycle detector is being kind of stupid.
Yeah.
Like, is it because the cycle detector is basically just literally never getting run? Or is there actually something weird and buggy in there? Because I was checking this out with a program. It's anywhere from 200 to 2,000, creations of actors can happen before one of them, where you're just spawning them one after another, right? One spawns the next, spawns the next, spawns the next, spawns the next. Do you get anywhere from 2,000 to 200,000 before the first one, before one earlier in the chain will be collected?
Okay.
So that could just be because the cycle detector runs so infrequently, because we're worried about that, which is a general bad case there, which is something to think about in general in the future, is that there are things that are doing cleanup like garbage collection that we don't want them to run all that often, right? But at the same time, there are these use cases where if people are spawning tons of things, we probably actually want a way to detect what's going on and make sure that we do it more often, right? Just as a thing to keep in mind as a learning, or there literally could be a bug in the cycle detector.
Yep, absolutely.
So I'm at least poking around in there to try and see if I can figure it out. But the cycle detector is a place I have never really spent much time.
Okay, that sounds good.
Could we do some kind of heuristic based on how often actors are being spawned?
That's a good point. That is not currently happening, and that's a really good point.
Yeah, that's kind of, part of what I wanted to talk about this is because, I think this could, have broader ramifications in general for the future, where an awful lot of what's in the runtime is very much oriented towards the case where you're not spinning up massive amounts of actors all the time. And it works really well in that case. But if you are spinning up tons and tons of actors, especially if they're supposed to be short-lived, then an awful lot of the assumptions go out the window and bad things can happen.
Yeah.
So is there, on the particular scheduler thread where the cycle detector is running, please forgive me because I don't know a lot about this part of the runtime, but on the particular thread where it's running, if we had some kind of counter that was local to that thread, that knows how many actors were spawned on that thread. I mean, not across all threads. You don't have to synchronize that, but if there's lots of actors being spun across all threads, you'd assume that some portion of them are being, you know, spawned on the thread where the cycle detector is going to run, and you can use that as a reasonable heuristic for how many are being spawned globally, at least relatively speaking.
Yeah, I think one scheduler thread's view of actor creation is as good as the global view when you're talking about a heuristic. I think you're absolutely right.
So what was that I saw? Where was that? So if I remember correctly, I was trying to bring up the code, but I don't remember where it is, that one of the changes that Dippin did to address some other problems was that the cycle detector specifically only runs on the first thread, right? Whatever the first thread is. And it only runs if it's been longer than a certain amount of time. Yeah. So there are two problems with that. One, if you were to block that first thread, right, because it's cooperative multitasking, that would certainly be a problem. Ignoring that one for a moment, the other thing, at least without doing that, the other thing that might be a reasonable thing to do as a short-term thing would be is to be looking at if the cycle detector was really like for some heuristic of saying unable to keep up with the work as it's coming in, right? That you lower the amount of time before it starts to run.
Yeah.
Right. Like if it's I don't even remember what it was. I think the number was like 10,000 some unit, might have been milliseconds. I'm not sure what it is. But if it's been, say, let's say it ran every second, right? If we can see in the same way that like the, oh, hey, there's a heuristic for an actor is getting overloaded because they can't keep up with the incoming messages. Oh, look, the cycle detector can't keep up with the amount of work for the actors that are being generated, then give the cycle detector more time.
Yeah. I'm going to propose something stupid. And this is more about saying, opening up the design space than it is about necessarily doing. But if the cycle detector, it wasn't run on scheduler threads at all, but was run on another thread, it was not pinged to a core, and gave itself sleep backoffs, accelerating sleep backoffs, based on how much work it did, so that if it only did a little bit, it gave itself a long sleep back off, and if it did a lot of work, it gave itself a short to no sleep back off. We might get the right behavior without having the interleaving with real work problem.
So that's an interesting first one, is to give it its own thread, right? If that looks promising, then a possible thing to do would be is to allow people to potentially either run it on a separate thread or perhaps to run the ACO and the cycle detector on the same thread.
Ah, that's quite interesting, yeah.
Because the ACO one, unless you're doing really high performance network stuff, should have plenty of cycles if you're doing like pinning and everything.
Yeah. That's a really good point. That seems rather attractive.
I will poke around a bit over the next couple of days and see what I see.
Awesome.
Okay. Um, 1330, investigate compilation to GPUs.
That's a really I think that one was marked for discussion during sync where, looks like it was.
Did I just forget to remove the marker?
It kind of looks like it, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, we didn't talk about
that last week.
Yeah.
Okay. And then 2975, no GC happening with cycles of 50,000 plus actors.
That's the one that got me started looking at 10.07, right? Yeah. So I'm not convinced from his original example that he had that there was anything wrong, right?
Okay.
And when I run his current example I have to run the current example with no block and pony GC one to see what happens. I know Eric did, but I'm not really sure on that. His original one before he knocked it down was a series of promises on promises on promises on promises. And from what it looked like to me is because like the promises, like if you use promises and you chain stuff together, like all of the actors that it's referencing with like a, hey, my callback is this blah, blah, blah will be held onto, as will the, for each promise, it's creating a new actor to actually handle the promise aspect of it. None of those are eligible to be garbage collected, even if they're technically done with their work, until you join and get the result back.
Yep.
So that like, so at least with his, In his first one was like a chain that was like 7 or 8 deep, something like that, for his advent of code. And I got to a certain place where I'm like, I can't guarantee that there's not a bug here. But it really looks to me like with as far as I can follow this chain of promises that I would expect this to do, you know, not to garbage collect anything until the very end of this program and suck up a ton of memory. But this one I haven't looked at yet.
Okay.
But it looks like Eric did find a bug where it seg faults sometime on shutdown. With his one with GC initial one and that.
All right.
2977.
Yeah.
Well, that's a bug. Okay, cool.
Cool.
Which one are we looking at? I was just adding a comment to the
2977, which was found while investigating 2975.
Yes. Which, by the way, looks so incredibly familiar to me, because if you garbage collect an actor while the cycle detector is running, that's where it crashes.
Oh.
I'm not saying it is the same thing, but the stuff that I was playing around with the cycle detector last night, that's if you garbage collect an actor while the cycle detector has a reference to it, that's where it dies.
Mm-hmm.
That is the backtrace.
Yeah.
Not guaranteeing that's it, but that is the backtrace that I get if I garbage collect an actor while the cycle, where it has no references to it. Its message queue is empty, but the cycle detector has a reference to it, and the cycle detector is running.
Yep.
I wouldn't have known that if I had looked at this before the playing around I did last night.
Okay.
I'm going to add a comment to that effect.
That sounds like a good thing to add. Congratulations, you've now touched it, and now you are partially responsible for it.
Don't you put that evil on me. Don't you put that evil on me, Andrew Charlie.
John, I'm just telling you how the world works.
Don't you put that on me.
So, quick update on LLVM 7 and the heap to stack thing. For some reason, using this LLVM debug version that I use just takes a lot of memory. It took this long to compile Phony C. I just ran the standard library test successfully with the heap to stack thing, the workaround disabled. So I'm not sure. I'm going to have to go back and look at the issues to see if there are other things that would fail instead of the standard library test, but the standard library test currently passed with the heap to stack re-enabled.
Okay. If you turn on the stat printing to get the transform prints, it should drop out information about what heap allocations it transformed to stack allocations. My apologies, I can't remember the flag to do that.
It's a flag to Pony C.
Yeah.
Hmm.
There's some sample code in the issue. Let me look it up.
Yeah, right now I was looking at the pull request for LLVM 4. That's 2303, but. Maybe. Are you talking about 1592 or no? What is it? Oh, 2371 is the okay. All right. Yeah. 2371 doesn't have a code example. All right. Well, I don't want to derail, so let's continue with other stuff. Want to dig into this further?
I think the thing that you're looking for is op stats, which is literally dash dash stats.
Okay. All right.
But my apologies, I'm not really sure.
So you're saying run that with the heap to stack workaround enabled and with the workaround disabled and see the difference?
Right. And you should be able to get a dump of all of the stack heap allocations that were turned into stack allocations from the compiler for the Albuquerque Zipony bug that went through.
Okay.
I don't see this flag. Where is this? It doesn't appear in the. Does that appear in the help?
Options.c, line 95.
Oh, there it is. I needed to grep the help in order to find it.
Okay.
I was like, is that in the help? Yes, it is. It is in the help.
All right. So I should just be able to run it with the workaround turned off and see that some heap to stack happen.
Yeah.
Okay. I will do that as soon as I finish trying to link libponyc.tests, because it's going to take about 10 minutes.
Ouch. Also, thank you.
So the bug doesn't always appear in debug mode, just FYI.
Sorry?
Oh, I was running in debug mode. Okay. All right.
Yeah, in debug mode, it doesn't try to do that optimization, right?
Yeah, thanks for the catch.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Any other issues we want to discuss? I think we've gone through all the ones that are marked for discussion. Anybody? Okay. Any other topics that anybody would like to discuss?
Not right now.
Okay.
I have not.
Google Summer of Code. I guess that's one that I'd like to just throw out real quick. We have a channel. We have a in Slack. We have a repo under Ponylang where people can submit ideas. The idea, basically, if you have something that you are interested in being a mentor for, please just write it up as an addition to the README and open a PR on that. If you have an idea, but you're not sure you want to be the mentor, but you want to kind of get the idea out to be captured, go ahead and open a GitHub issue. And at some point, some of us can go back and we can kind of sort through and maybe try to find mentors for things. I was looking at one or two other projects that got accepted last year, and not all of their ideas necessarily had mentors. So I don't know if that's a strict requirement, but if, you know, it's probably better to have mentors than listed than just have a bunch of things without mentors. Eventually, if somebody decided they wanted to try to do the thing, then we'd need to find them a mentor. But
how does the acceptance thing work? Is it like Pony as a whole gets accepted and then we can do projects, or is it specific projects that we've listed get accepted?
Yeah, my understanding is that basically you submit a projects page, or what they call an ideas list, and then Google decides whether or not to accept your project with all its ideas. Once the projects have been accepted, then it's basically opened up to students to go through and find an idea from any of the projects that are there and apply to work on it. And then I think the people who maintain the project, I think there's like a point person who basically says, yes, this person could do this, or no, we don't want this person for this thing. So there's a few different layers to it. So the deadline on February 6th is for us to basically have the ideas list put together and then fill out whatever else needs to be filled out for the application. So I was gonna take a look at that and take care of filling that out and point it towards our list of ideas. So that's kind of the process there. Make sense?
Yeah, I think that's super
cool. All right. So yeah, if you have any ideas, or if you have any ideas that you would like to be a mentor on, please add them. Again, the deadline I think is February 6th. So we have about 3 weeks.
Sounds good.
Alrighty. Well, if there's nothing else, then I think we can conclude the meeting. Give me one second and I will turn off the recording.